From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. On this week's show, a look at how women's magazines address the health issues of African American women.
As an African American woman, I feel that it is my responsibility to do this type of research.
And find out how Kansas City has become a powerhouse in the world domino scene.
I don't want you to like me when we're playing together, because if you like me, that means you're probably winning. So I don't want you to like me when we're competing. I want you to hate me.
And we'll check in with a father-daughter duo who have gone from singing on the plaza to the national stage.
For anything in music, I feel like the street has always got me ready to perform.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
Women's magazines are missing opportunities to reduce health disparities in African American women. That's according to KU professor Crystal Lumpkins. She recently conducted a study on how health information is communicated in major women's magazines. Susan sat down with Lumpkins to find out more.
The magazines that we looked at included Redbook, Good Housekeeping, Miss Magazine, and then Essence Magazine. And out of all those magazines, what was interesting, there were a total of 100 stories that basically had specific health topics in them. And they ranged from HIV/AIDS stories, reproductive stories. But out of all those magazines, it's really surprising that they did not really do a great job. Now, mind you, this was a 2004 sample. So I know that a lot of things have changed, but at that time, there were several gaps in those stories specifically targeting African-American women and then those specific issues that impact African-American women, such as HIV/AIDS, obesity, those types of things.
Now, what inspired you to study how women's magazines can reduce health disparities in African-American women?
Well, what inspired me was my aunt. She had, unfortunately, she was diagnosed with breast cancer, and this was in 2001. But thankfully, she is a breast cancer survivor, so that really compelled me to do this type of research. As you probably know, that magazines are one of the leading sources of information for women because they are entertaining. They provide information. So, you know, magazines are well positioned as, you know, a vehicle that journalists can, you know, get that word out there. They can report these types of stories in a way that will really be appealing. It's not something that, you know, people would just probably gloss over.
So let's talk about your study. Mm-hmm. Now, you surveyed popular women's magazines. How did you choose the ones to survey?
Well, I looked at the Magazine Publishers of America. So went through that and looked at some of the magazines that had the largest circulation, and then those that were, of course, popular magazines among women. And Essence in particular was the ethnic magazine that was compared to the mainstream magazines in this study and is a very popular magazine among African Americans.
So what were your major findings?
The major findings were that there were several gaps where out of the 100 stories that we found, that a lot of those, say for instance in Essence Magazine, out of those the 6 months, and it was a 6 month sample, that two stories were found about HIV/AIDS, which that is a huge issue among the African American community.
You mention in your research that being able to infuse spirituality mm-hmm. in some of the health messaging for African American women is particularly important.
Yes.
Why?
Well, because we are a very spiritual and religious people. research has shown that there's a Pew Center report out that was 2009, I believe, that showed that nearly 80% of African Americans surveyed across the country were religious, meaning that they spent at least one time or twice a week in church service.
So you mentioned that some of the mainstream magazines don't have much content at all directed toward Black women. How would you recommend that they handle that issue?
Well, yes, I would say that focusing on an individual that is, an African-American woman, that would certainly be a way of doing that. One thing that we do have to realize that these are mainstream magazines. They have to appeal to a broader audience than, say, for instance, an ethnic magazine like Essence magazine, because that is their primary target. But one thing that these the mainstream magazines, I feel, as you know, a journalist has the responsibility of reporting those things that are out there. If an individual is profiled, that is kind of a face for thousands of women out there, and they would most likely pick up that magazine.
You know, magazine editors say their job is to sell magazines, not to reduce health disparities in certain groups, and that they have to choose content, like you said, that a broad audience will like. So what's the way around that from your perspective?
The way around that is to say, I mean, we're in an environment where we need to be conscious of supporting what's going on around us. I know that doesn't translate right now into dollars, the bottom line, but I would just say that health is important. I mean, for goodness sakes, we just went through this whole healthcare debate and, you know, healthcare law and everything. And so I would say that people are very conscious of their health. And it would be well worth advertisers and whoever is supporting that magazine to invest in that, because that's something that people are going to buy into.
But, you know, some of these mainstream magazines, in fairness, they may not have or may not think they have large African-American readership. Mm-hmm. So I guess their point would be, well, we could do all this health messaging in these articles, but, you know, our readership among the African-American community isn't really there. Wouldn't they have to start attracting readership first? Or isn't that a chicken and egg kind of dilemma?
I feel that these mainstream magazines have a social responsibility, essentially. So if the problem persists, not just African-Americans, but, you know, Hispanics or whoever else is suffering from these different diseases or cancers, just think about that. That translates into more cost. I mean, if we are being preventive and we are trying to address these situations, then maybe it'll be better for society, essentially.
If you could only pick, let's say, two main health disparity issues that affect African-American women, what would you like magazines to focus on?
I think I would say, if I could just pinpoint two, I would say, you know, it would be nutrition. And then also it would have to be obesity, because, as you said, that obesity leads to so many other things and so many, you know, of diseases and cancers.
Some people might say, what's the big deal here? I mean, all this health information that's out here these days, why can't African Americans get a health information, because it's everywhere now? I mean, why do they have to rely on magazines anyway? How would you respond to that?
Why get all this information out there? Well, the health disparities are still there. Until these health disparities, until that gap is closed, we are going to have to keep working at it.
What recommendations, based on your study, would you have for journalists who are in the magazine business?
I would say to be open to covering stories about African American women, because what they place in their magazines, especially if they are mainstream magazines, that it has a far-reaching effect. And that not only means getting into the hands of people that need it, but also into the hands of people like doctors or health professionals that can help get this word to African Americans as well.
Crystal Lumpkins is a professor at KU School of Journalism. She recently published a study on how women's magazines can play a role in reducing health disparities in African American women. This week, Royals fans had their best week in years. Kansas City hosted Major League Baseball's 2012 All-Star festivities.
Good days on the baseball diamond have been few and far between around here for more than a decade. But the All-Star Games gave baseball fans a rare moment of mid-season hope. KCUR's Jeremy Bernfeld has more.
The Royals have won the World Series every time they've made the playoffs the last 27 years. Problem is, they've only made the playoffs once in that span, in 1985.
There are some times where I think if I lived somewhere else, it might be easy to just turn around and find a new team.
That's Michael Engel. He lives in Lawrence, Kansas, and he's been a Royals fan for every one of those 27 long years. Engel is editor of the Royals blog Kings of Kauffman, so he watches a lot of Royals games. Enough games that he's been pushed close to the breaking point.
You start tearing your hair out because you wonder, you know, when's it going to turn around? Why do I do this? Am I wasting my time? Do I need to start watching soccer? That's what it starts to feel like because, you know, Sporting KC, they're in second or third place right now. The Royals, you know, they're still in fourth.
There's an entire generation of Royals fans that hasn't seen their team in the postseason. Engel is one of the lucky ones. He actually remembers the 1985 World Series. If only barely.
The 1-0 pitch. High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Four 100 loss seasons in 5 years. Trading away popular stars like Johnny Damon, Zach Greinke, Carlos Beltran. No improvement for years. Only the most faithful fans have survived. Again, Michael Engel.
It feels like the Royals have been rebuilding since about 1995. And every year it's like a three-year plan and it never comes around. It's almost like being in Stalinist Russia.
This year, though, was supposed to be the year things turned around. The team was ready to harvest burgeoning talent from a well-regarded farm system, and young players with star potential were making their ways to the big league club. And Kansas City was hosting the 2012 All-Star Game. It was supposed to be the perfect stage on which to shine the spotlight on a new team, a new brand of Kansas City baseball. This is our time, the team declared.
But after so many firsts, I'm looking forward to what's next. Kansas City, this is our time.
But our time turned into more of the same, especially after a rash of injuries and an early 12-game losing streak cooled expectations pretty quickly. At the All-Star break, the Royals were sitting in their customary almost 10 games back in their division, nestled comfortably in fourth place. But Tuesday's All-Star game provided a bright spot for Royals fans to focus on. And bright spots can't often be seen in Kansas City in the middle of July. That had Royals fans crowding the streets for the pre-All-Star game parade on a hot summer day.
Our last big celebration was in 1985.
That's Rob Wesley from Raytown, Missouri. He said it just felt great to live in the center of the baseball universe once again, if only temporarily.
It's a new feeling, but it's a great feeling to bring it home, to actually get the opportunity to have something of this magnitude in Kansas City.
Seeing the All-Stars up close was a treat, Wesley says, but not quite the event he'd been hoping for.
No, the parade I really want to see is it's going to be a little bit colder, but it's be when everybody in the whole city and the world will know that they have made it. They have arrived again like they have in 1985.
Royals fans hope to see a passel of All-Stars on the field at Kauffman Stadium again soon. Only this time, they hope it's in October. Jeremy Bernfeld, KCUR News.
Coming up, we may not be baseball champs, but Kansas City is home to several gold-winning Domino's champions. You're listening to Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. This weekend, the tiny town of Andalusia, Alabama, hosts the 37th annual World Championships of Dominoes. And in the last 15 years of these almost four decades, a lot of the world champions have hailed from Kansas City. Alex Smith met with a couple of the champs just before they left for Andalusia to find out the reason for Kansas City's Domino's dominance.
That's what he was down in.
Y'all were putting up the table properly.
Even at 6 o'clock on a Monday afternoon, there's plenty of action at the Green Duck Lounge. Pool players sink balls, baseball fans yell at the TV, and regulars argue about everything from politics to the Bible. In one corner, a handful of men huddle around a small table covered in dominoes, shouting their commentaries on a fast game. But at the center of the bluster, two men calmly stare at the arrangement of tiles. On one side is Jerome Wooten. Like everyone here, he slaps his domino down hard on the table, but he says he doesn't have much need for intimidation tactics.
Yeah, I'm more of a humble type of player, you know. Since I win a lot, I don't want to run the players off, so I tend not to say too much trash talk.
Jerome Wooten may not be a household name, but everyone here knows him as the world champion of dominoes. It's a title he's held for three of the past 4 years. Across the table from him is Travis Newsom, who's a former two-time singles world champion. These two men are towering figures in the world of dominoes, working sometimes as teammates, sometimes as rivals, and the Green Duck is their second home. Wooten says they come here 6 days a week, 4 or 5 hours a day, preparing for major league competition by taking on bragging wannabes.
Who's your daddy?
Now, these guys do a lot of trash talking, but they're not that good.
Who's your daddy?
But the competition will ramp up this weekend for Wooten and Newsom when they compete in the Domino's World Championships. Actually, two different annual contests call themselves the World Championships. There's one in Jamaica, but the Alabama contest is the one Wooten and Newsom go to. Wooten first went to Andalusia, Alabama in 1999, and even he was shocked at the devotion to dominoes he saw there.
The first time I went, I thought it was actually too much dominoes being played. We arrived there at Friday morning around 2 o'clock in the morning, and they were playing when we got there. They played up until 6:30 that morning. Everyone went and showered, came back down, we ate breakfast, and the tournament starts at 8 o'clock. They repeated that cycle the whole weekend. So a lot of the guys didn't even sleep. It was like almost 24 hours of dominoes played every day. I thought I liked dominoes until I went to Andalusia.
Kansas City's dominoes ascendancy started in 1973. That's when Travis Newsom moved here to join his four brothers to work in real estate. The brothers grew up playing dominoes after school in Chapel Hill, Texas. They brought to Kansas City their love for competition and strategy and quickly earned respect among local players. Travis Newsom says that a focus on strategy is why Kansas City has so many champion players today.
When we play dominoes, we talk about plays. Why did you make that play? What was your thinking when you made that play? Did you not know this was going to happen when you made that play? That's what we do when we're playing. And I have learned from that that type of discussion, that type of conversation has really helped to put our game at a different level.
Travis Newsom won the singles championship in 1988 and 2003 and the doubles title in 1999. His brothers Robert, Jerry, and Sterling are also past winners of the top doubles prize. Another Kansas City player, Wayne Morrow, also won the singles championship in 2001, but the Newsom brothers more or less ruled Kansas City's dominoes scene for years. That was until 1998, when Jerome Wooten first came along.
There's no person in Kansas City or no person in this country that I'm aware of that's even close to his level of his game. Like what I say, when people talk about Jerome Wooten, I say, well, Jerome is number one in Kansas City, and we don't have a number two or a number three or a number four. The next person after Jerome is probably like a number five. So that's how good he is.
There's a long tradition of dominoes in African American culture, and it was in this tradition Jerome Wooten and Travis Newsom learned and played the game. But white players organize and are the main participants in a lot of tournaments, especially in the South. Travis Newsom was invited to the Alabama World Championships for the first time in 1978, and he says it was an eye-opening experience.
It was really funny because we walk into this gymnasium, and there are, at that time, they must have had 800 people there playing dominoes. And there were no blacks there. So we said, wait a minute, white folks can't play dominoes. And we thought we'd just win it really with ease and come back at Kansas City with that $4,000 first place check. But that was not the case.
Today, after both previously working in real estate, Jerome Wooten and Travis Newsom are now full-time dominoes players. They travel to many contests a year, and the prize money for a single tournament can be in the tens of thousands of dollars. Tournament play makes dominoes almost a different game than what goes on at the Green Duck. At professional competitions, loud trash-talking is pretty rare, but Travis Newsom says psychology is still important wherever you play.
My game is to make my opponent feel inferior, and intimidation, that's part of my game.
How do you do that? How do you make a person across the table from you feel?
Well, maybe by how fast I play. You know, when they play a domino, I'm ready to play, and I'll almost hit his hand putting my domino down, and I'll say certain things, kind to demean my competition a little bit. You know, that's all kind of part of it. And once we walk away from the domino table, well, everything is cool, but at the domino table, I tell people all the time, I'm not trying to be your friend when I'm playing dominoes. I don't want you to like me when we're playing together, because if you like me, that means you're probably winning. So I don't want you to like me when we're competing. I want you to hate me.
Newsom is also a dominoes teacher. He's got a business called Dominoes Ed KC that runs dominoes after school programs, and he tutors a few students privately. Newsom says that to be good, players need to learn skills similar to counting cards.
Now we say, look, if there are seven dominoes over here, and if two have already been played, and you have two in your hand, then you know there are only three of them left. And you have to decide whether your opponent has those or whether or not they may be in the boneyard. So we have to teach that type of thing to the kids. And what I call that's deductive reasoning. What's the probability of him having this particular domino? If he doesn't have this domino, they're not going to win the game. So now I got to make a decision as to whether or not he really has this domino or not.
Great play, Travis. Good, man.
But these days, Travis Newsom has more than strategy on his mind. He's currently organizing a tournament for the Satchel Paige Foundation to take place in October in Kansas City, and he hopes this will become an annual, nationally recognized event. Jerome Wooten, on the other hand, is focusing on the upcoming World Championship and on offering the occasional tip to news reporters.
You should have asked me, am I going to win this year? And the answer would have been yes, thus I am going to win this year.
For Casey Currents, this is Alex Smith.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
It's time now for By Farm Roots, a series from Harvest Public Media in which we hear American stories and memories of rural life. Harvest Public Media's Jeremy Bernfeld joins us again to set up this next story.
I met Kate Edwards, a young farmer in Solon, Iowa, late in the spring, right as some of her vegetables were beginning to poke up from the ground. Edwards didn't always work in the fields. No, she came back to the farm after college, grad school, and a stint as an environmental engineer. On a windy day at her small farm, Edwards told me that for her, farming means family.
My name is Kate Edwards. I'm a farmer in Iowa. I have a vegetable CSA on 1 acre of ground. I feed 30 families on that 1 acre and grow a wide variety of vegetables and direct market through the CSA to families in the community. When I was a little girl, I spent a lot of time with my grandpa, and I was kind of his sidekick. I think that connection that I had, my grandpa is a very, he has a love for the land and a love for taking care of it. And he's always been a farmer and he'll always be a farmer. Because of the nature of what I'm doing being vegetable related, which is more traditionally what would happen in a garden on a farm, I also feel a very special connection to my grandma as well. And it's really fun. When I first got started, I caught myself, you know, calling my grandma, you know, maybe once a month saying, what do I need to do for this crop? Because she, you know, she gardened for 50 years and really she was a huge teacher to me. And, you know, last summer my grandma came down and helped me wash tomatoes and just loved me in that way. It's an honor and a privilege, because to think that someone would want to learn from me, like the girl that works for me, or the volunteers that come out that I get to teach, or the kids that come out that I get to talk to, it's this huge privilege to think that I have knowledge that I get to share. And it's kind of humbling, because the only reason I have this knowledge is because other people have shared it with me. And so it's an amazing kind of humbling experience to see that kind of come full circle. It was really interesting. My grandma and I were walking on their farm just this spring, and we were walking past the black raspberry bushes, and she said something to the effect of, not many people care about these things anymore. And I said, Grandma, I do. And the reason that I do is because you guys taught me to. And I care about the seasons. I care about when things are ripe. I care about making sure I get up to the farm, you know, the 2 weeks in July when the black raspberries are ready, because I have those deep memories of being on the farm with my grandpa and grandma and them teaching me where those are. I care about those things, and I learn to watch the weather and to watch the seasons because they do.
To hear more My Farm Roots stories or to share your own, visit harvestpublicmedia.org/myfarmroots. In 1944, the town of West Plains was dealt a serious blow when it received word from the War Department that one of its brightest and most promising young men had gone missing. But his body was never accounted for, until now, that is. KSMU's Jennifer Davidson has this story.
I'm standing right now in the Oaklawn Cemetery in West Plains, and right before me is a modest grave marker that simply reads, Staff Sergeant John E. Hogan died in action. It has a pair of wings and a propeller engraved on it. But this grave is empty. The stone is nothing more than a marker to remember the young soldier who had hopes of finishing up his time at the University of Missouri and going on to graduate school to become a field biologist. But now, nearly 70 years after Hogan's plane went down over Germany, the Department of Defense says his remains have finally been found and his relatives notified, and that John Hogan is, at long last, returning home to the United States to be laid to rest.
John and I grew up right at the tail end of the horse and buggy days. I don't mean there weren't cars, there were. But there were also an awful lot of horses and people coming to town in horse-drawn wagons.
That's Jack McNevin. He served in the Marines in World War II, and he played football with John Hogan in high school. The two young men graduated in 1942, a few months after the attack on Pearl Harbor. Their futures had a cloud of ambiguity hanging over them.
We all knew that in 1941, in December 41, we all knew that sooner or later, everybody that was eligible was going to go.
McNevin recalls being stationed in the Pacific Theater with his fellow Marines when he heard the news about his former classmate.
I just remember that in one of the letters my mom wrote, she just said that they'd got word that John Hogan's plane was shot down and he was missing and presumed dead.
It was September of 1944. All the Army was able to confirm was that Hogan's B-17, on which he was a gunner, fell out of formation on a mission over Germany. Hogan's plane was never seen from nor heard from again by his squadron. The squadron had come under anti-aircraft fire on its bombing mission on the oil refineries of Merseburg. One crew member parachuted out and became a POW. The rest were presumed dead. 9 years later, his parents received a letter from the Department of the Army telling them that an American investigation had included a search for their son's body in cemeteries in Belgium, France, and Germany. The letter reads, quote, "The Department of the Army has been forced to conclude that the remains of your loved one are not recoverable. May the knowledge of your son's honorable service to his country be a source of sustaining comfort to you," end quote. Fast forward to the 1990s. Jessica Pierno is a spokeswoman at the Defense Prisoner of War Missing Personnel Office, or the DPMO.
In 1991, a German citizen was digging a grave in a cemetery for one of his own family members. And as he was doing his work, he discovered a metal identification tag that was from a U.S. soldier.
Those dog tags were handed over to German officials, and the American government was notified. But due to what she calls a lot of red tape surrounding German law, Pierno says it took 17 years before U.S. investigators could bring up those remains.
They were able to excavate that entire site and recover remains from what we believe to be the rest of the crew members.
Investigators contacted one of Hogan's relatives and asked for a DNA sample. It was a match, confirming that his remains had finally been positively identified. Now, the U.S. government is able to confirm that 4 of the 8 missing crew members have been identified through DNA. John Hogan was the brother of the late Judge Robert E. Hogan, who sat for many years on the bench at the Missouri Court of Appeals in Springfield, and he was the cousin of the late Springfield businessman Jack Hogan of the Hogan Land Title Company. Today, Judge Hogan's son, Ed, is a neurologist with Washington University in St. Louis.
I do know my family's close. I do know how hard that was for them to give up, you know, one of their family members, you know, for my dad and his brother. I guess what I'd say, and I'm very appreciative that things have come up and that we know and that they've brought his remains back. I just really wish it would have happened when my dad was still alive.
John Hogan made up to 15 bombing missions over Europe on the B-17, known as the Flying Fortress. It was the main bomber used by the Americans over Nazi Germany. Another man who knew Hogan in high school is Joe Spears, also of West Plains. He, too, was a gunner on the B-17 in the European theater.
We were kind of a cocky group. We'd had it drilled into us that we were invincible, and that's before we discovered that we weren't.
Spears and Hogan did not fly together. Spears was based in southern Italy and Hogan in England. But Spears says the crew members of a B-17 respected each other tremendously. And boy, did they revere their airplane.
I went to Wright-Patterson Air Museum in Dayton, Ohio. And one of the attendants at the museum told me it was not unusual for an older person to come in and put his arms around the B-17 and cry like a baby. Because there I go again. You can't explain it. It was just, we swore by them.
He says the sight of 28 B-17 bombers flying in formation was an awesome sight, and that the planes could come in full of gaping holes and still make a perfect landing. The B-17 flew at an altitude close to 30,000 feet, he says.
We wore silk gloves under our electric heated gloves, so that if you had to yank your glove off to work on a gun, your hand wouldn't freeze to the metal. If you didn't have this silk glove on, it would freeze, absolutely freeze, and when you pulled it off, you left the skin. And we wore all of the clothes we could get on, and we're still cold.
John Hogan's parents and brothers never did learn what happened to his body. Jack McNevin worked with John's mother in the West Plains post office.
I do remember her. She was a very quiet woman, very attractive woman. And she never did really recover wholly completely from not knowing where my boy is.
The DPMO estimates that of the 16 million Americans who served in World War II, 73,000 of them are still unaccounted for. But John Hogan has just been marked off that list. 68 years after his young body shipped off to war, it will finally be returning stateside. He's scheduled to be laid to rest in Arlington National Cemetery in August with full military honors. For KSMU News, I'm Jennifer Davidson.
After the break, a Kansas City father-daughter singing duo makes it to America's Got Talent. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
In area news this week, the long-awaited Major League Baseball All-Star Game was played. Plans for streetcars rolled ahead. And the KU Cancer Center was officially granted National Cancer Institute designation. Steve Bell looks back at those and other top stories of the week on the KCUR Weekend News Review.
Announcing National Cancer Center designation for the KU Cancer Center, Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius emphasized how significant the designation is.
Nearly every new cancer drug brought to market in the past decade has been based on research conducted at one of these centers, and that the University of Kansas Medical Center is now joining this select group.
Dignitaries at the ceremony added that it will guarantee the latest cancer drugs and treatments are available in the area and provide a boost to health education and the economy. North Kansas City Hospital was back in the news for what its board didn't want. The board sought an injunction stopping any city plans to sell the hospital, saying only the board has the authority to do that. Board Chair Dr. Mike Montgomery added,
"We feel like that we're doing a good job. We're maintaining a quality hospital and that we don't need to be sold."
As of Friday afternoon, the city had made no public response. The state of Kansas announced that there will be an audit of troubles with the $40 million computer upgrade that has caused long lines at local DMV offices. But Secretary of Revenue Nick Jordan said some of the issues stem from things like slow internet speeds and training problems.
"I'm not going to stand here and say that we implemented it perfectly. We did the best we could."
The state of Kansas is withholding the final payment to the contractor until some problems are resolved. Missouri Lieutenant Governor Peter Kinder and other top Republicans filed suit over Democratic Secretary of State Robin Carnahan's using the ballot language "deny access to affordable insurance" for a measure on the health insurance exchange.
"What she has done is a slap in the face to the General Assembly and an insult to Missouri voters."
Republicans in the legislature had sent the plan to restrict implementing the federal health care law to the voters rather than sending it to Governor Nixon and having him veto it. Nixon did veto a bill allowing employers to refuse to offer insurance coverage for contraception. The governor said current state law already provides protection of religious objections, and
"this bill would allow insurance companies to impose their will and deny contraceptive coverage to women."
Republicans say they will override the veto. The Kansas City City Council approved $2 million for advance planning on a proposed downtown streetcar line. Councilman Dick Davis kicked off the idea with a brief pep talk.
"Our council is moving forward. We're going to get that streetcar project built."
The appropriations passed unanimously. Wrapping up the week, 82 Kansas counties were declared drought disaster areas. Hyatt asked for big incentives to build a luxury hotel near the plaza. Prosecutors filed child endangerment charges against the boyfriend of a woman accused of keeping her 10-year-old daughter locked in a closet. Sporting Kansas City earned a berth in soccer's U.S. Open Championship tournament, and with total attendance of 124,000 a day, Major League Baseball claimed success for Kansas City All-Star Game Week. So did law enforcement groups that seized more than $540,000 worth of counterfeit Major League Baseball merchandise. This is KCUR.
Artist Alan Winkler's whimsical paper and metal cutouts of people and animals are instantly recognizable. His style has been described as deliberately naive. Winkler's a 1975 graduate of the Kansas City Art Institute and also an accomplished drummer and teacher. For a series called Artists in Their Own Words, artist Alan Winkler talks about mixing it all up in a new mural tucked inside a school cafeteria.
"Well, my name's Alan Winkler. I was given completely free rein and all the paint I could use. I came into the cafeteria here and thought this would be a fun space to paint. It's very big, and I envisioned little kids eating in here. I told them I would do the cafeteria. A long time ago, my kids started at Academy Lafayette. I mean, that was like 12 years ago or something. And at that time, the school was extremely small. It was French immersion, still is, and it was a very good school for my kids. And I was the substitute teacher. Eventually, I became the art teacher. And I just thought it'd be nice to give back a little something. The last time I was here, I worked to Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. Today, I have some amazing African music playing. I love music of all kinds, and I've been listening to it. Besides being large walls here, there were things in the way of making it a big open canvas where the heat comes out or the cold air. I mean, and there's, you know, where you get your food, where you bring your trays back. So I had to incorporate all these crazy things into my artwork. So this big open door, gaping hole in the middle of the wall, I made that the mouth to a very large head. And this other grate here where heating comes out, I made that into the woman's wraparound sunglasses. I just tried to use what was here. And over there, that guy is holding onto the bell that rings because it was just there near his hand when I was painting him, so I made him holding it. Well, there's paintings of people doing handstands, walking on their hands, a giant cat portrait, and a purple elephant. There's a zebra with yellow shoes on. There's these dancing men who are like twisted like pretzels. There's a man who came out of the fire, and he's like a fire god or fire man. And there's an abstract kind of figure. There are people from other planets. Just a fantasy painting.
You can find photos of Alan Winkler's mural called A Celebration of Diversity at Academy Lafayette's new K-2 campus, and more about the music he listens to while he's working on our website at kcur.org. Just click on Arts and Culture. Winkler's story was produced by KCUR's Laura Spencer. The Artists in Their Own Words series is supported by the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Kansas City's own father-daughter singing duo, Maurice and Shanice Hayes, are competing in NBC's national competition, America's Got Talent, for a $1 million prize.
People get ready to the train to join, picking up passengers from coast to coast. Faith is the key, open the doors and
before hitting primetime, Maurice and Shanice were popular street performers on the Country Club Plaza, and we profiled the two of them about a year ago. Now they're holding their own on the national stage. So far, crowd reaction and judges' comments have been positive. Susan met up with them to see how all this national attention has been affecting their lives.
Well, I've never been interested in joining any shows because I never was a talent show person. But my dad, he just told me that we should just go ahead and go. So that's it. I just went with my dad.
Well, you know, they've said that you're a superstar. And so do you see yourself in the future reaching that superstar status?
I can see myself. And I want to be at that. Not more of a superstar, but more of an artist. Mm-hmm. I want to be an artist, and I want to be able to give back and help. And that's what I really want to do, not more of a just superstar for cameras and everything. I just want to be an artist, and I just want to sing.
But how has being on TV changed your thinking about your future plans?
My future plans still remain the same. I'm still going to college. I just enrolled into Penn Valley. I'm always going to work on my music. So everything is still the same for me.
So what are you going to study in college?
I'm thinking about going to music therapy, but I also want to help children with cancer and like autism. But I'm trying to work that way into like combining them both. So I'm still thinking about how I'm going to be able to do that. I was thinking about being like a pediatrician, but I want a double major for sure.
So you're starting off at Penn Valley, then going to transfer later on?
Yeah, I'm on a scholarship to finish my 3 years at Penn Valley, and then they switched me over to UMKC to finish my the rest of my years in my major.
What overwhelms you the most? Is it just being on a national stage? Is it the travel?
It's performing it with my daughter. Because I've traveled and I've been on national stages before. I've been on, there's some very important engagements, but there's no engagement that I have done can compare being on that stage with before that many people in that spotlight with my daughter.
So let's play What If. What if you win? Then what?
If I win, if we win, then... I don't know. If we win, then we win. We take home the bacon. I'm gonna try to help my family out and continue my education and continue singing. Well, I really want to make a career. Well, if you know, if anything happens, well, I'm gonna try to make a career out of singing.
What are your thoughts about people who have said, "Well, now, after all of this national attention, Shaunice may have to go her own way"? Because I heard some people suggesting that.
I think that eventually that's something that she may have to do. But for now, we are a vocal duo. And this is, they need to understand that this is not about me because I've always had a career in music. This is really to launch a career for Shaunice. And she would benefit from it a lot more than I ever could. So I kind of agree with what they're saying, that she, there's no doubt in my mind that Shaunice could be a solo performer. I would always be there for her if she was.
What do you think when you hear people say that?
Right now, of course, we're going to be singing together. And of course, in the future, eventually, I will have to sing on my own. And I mean, my father, he's been here all this way right by my side, and he's training me this whole entire time, and he's getting me ready for to be on my own, because he's already done what he wanted to do, and now it's my time. And I don't think they see how my father's there just guiding me and helping me along the way. But eventually, yeah, I'm gonna have to go on my own, but right now we are a father and daughter vocal duo, and we're gonna do this together.
Well, you've certainly prepared well for this moment. Did that preparation kick in? Because you've done so many performances, and so
we perform a lot before, and we perform a lot on the street. And I feel like performing on the street got me ready for, well, actually, it's getting me ready for anything that's coming my way, because I've been through so much training with my father. And so for anything in music, I feel like the street has always got me ready to perform.
Any Plaza performances planned anytime soon?
Well, last weekend we sang at the Plaza, but it really depends on the weather because it's been very hot.
So have you heard much from Kansas City fans who've seen you on TV?
Oh, I have a lot of fans. I have a lot of supporters, and I'm very thankful for the support that we're getting from our city.
What are some comments that they've made that really stood out for you?
Some people never knew I sing before, so some people are in shock, or some people are, oh, I can't believe a big voice come out of a so little body, you know, stuff like that. I hear that a lot.
I want to thank the people that have supported us thus far, that has taken the time to vote for us, that keeps us in this competition. I would like to let them know that we really care, and thank them and hope that we deserve their support. We don't want people to vote for us because we're from the city. We want them to vote for us because we deserve it, because we are doing the part that need to be done to win this competition.
Shaunice and Maurice Hayes, thank you for being on KC Currents, and good luck to you in your competition, or wishing you well in your competition.
Thank you.
Skylark, have you anything to say to me? Won't you tell me where my love is?
Paseo High School graduate Shaunice Hayes and her father Maurice Hayes are competing on NBC's America's Got Talent. We're going out today with Shaunice singing Skylark.
Skylark, have you seen a valley green with spring? shadows and the rain. To a blossom covered land. And in your lonely vine, haven't you heard music in the night? Wonderful music, faint as the willow whistle, pretty as the moon, sad as a gypsy, serenading the moon. Skylark, I don't know if you can find. Won't you leave me there? And in your lonely vine, haven't you heard music in the night? Wonderful music, faint as a willow whistle, pretty as a moon.
Thanks for tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast. Find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter @kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Sylvia, with associate producers Alex Smith and Suzanne Hogan. Our intern is Zach Lewandowski, and theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.